I'm thrilled to be joined today by Keisha Gibson and Deidre Cruz. Both Dr. Gibson and Dr. Cruz are ASN counselors. They're also have been leaders in ASN's efforts to promote diversity, equity, inclusion, as well as to pursue healthcare justice. We have a wide range of topics we'd like to talk about, but before we start, Dr. Gibson, I'd like you to introduce yourself.
Well, I am really happy to be here today. So my name is Keisha Gibson. I'm a pediatric nephrologist practicing at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I have been a part of ASN Council now for 3 years. It's been a real privilege to be a part of this amazing leadership team. And I've had a long-term interest in really thinking about how we best serve the patients that walk through our door. So I'm really excited to have this conversation today.
Dr. Cruz, would you mind introducing yourself as well?
Sure, I'd be delighted. I'm also equally as excited to be engaged in this conversation today. So I'm Deidre Cruz. I'm an adult nephrologist and professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, and where I also serve as deputy director of our Center for Health Equity. And after serving in a number of different roles within ASN recently, joined council, currently serving as secretary, and really excited about this conversation that we're going to get to have today.
Deidre, you represented ASN on the joint task force with the National Kidney Foundation that was focused on reassessing the inclusion of race in the diagnosis of kidney diseases. We all called it the EGFR task force for short. I'm curious, just maybe as a starting point, what was the overall goal for this task force?
Yeah, so the overall goal was to really look at what had been a practice for the last two decades, in our field, and that was the use of equations for estimating GFR that incorporated a modifier if a person was identified or identified themselves, ideally, as either Black or African American. And the work of the task force I think was really launched by calls within our community and in the kidney community, as well as outside of the kidney community, for a reassessment of the use of race in a number of different medical algorithms. And we were the first to tackle it, I think, in this really systematic way. But really, the overall goal was to take a careful look at the implications of that practice and to engage a number of different stakeholders, both clinicians as well as patients and learners as well, around this to understand their perspectives, as well as to review the literature that was relevant to really helping us think about how these equations were developed, what the implications are them or for them were, and then of course ultimately our task force then recommended a new equation for adoption in really all laboratories across the U.S. that did not include a race modifier, but instead was an equation that was refit, a refit version of the CKD epidemiology collaboration equation that did not include this modifier for race.
What is, you had mentioned that the task force spent some time on the history of including race in clinical algorithms. Why, I'm just wondering if you could explain why that is so problematic.
Yeah, so the reason that we spent some time on it, and certainly in the course of our meetings and our deliberations, got to hear from a number of different scholars who have examined this issue pretty carefully. This was really important for us to undertake. And as far as the reasons why, sort of race has been included, many would argue that it's rooted in the fact that race has been kind of equated as having biological impact, this is really born out of even centuries of sort of a racist or sort of discriminatory view of certain groups as being inferior to others. So in particular here, we've been focusing on Black individuals, and certainly there's a long history in this country of Black persons being viewed as inferior to white individuals. And unfortunately, the scientific community, even dating back again centuries ago, really contributed a lot to what was then perpetuated as these kind of stereotypes around these presumed biological differences between racial groups, when in fact these people who sort of put these ideas forward were in many cases doing it as a way to continue to place Black people in a sort of a separate class, in a lower class than white individuals. And so that unfortunately it entered into all sectors of our society, not just, I think we generally think of it as being more of a kind of a something we see in our political structure or in kind of other sectors, but it also entered medical society as well, and including in the practice of how we then diagnose certain health conditions, where we, through various reports that had come out, again, dating many, many years back, where it would be considered that, you know, well, we need to have one sort of assessment if a person is considered to be a part of this racial categorization versus another. And that then led to more and more scholars then, even in more contemporary periods, when they would conduct studies, they would then think, okay, well, we're going to include race in this sort of analysis. And in the case of you know, in our discipline, certainly there was studies that had then looked at racial differences in creatinine, and that led to then finding that there was this at least based on the population that was studied, that there was this for every sort of level of measured GFR, there was a different value that was observed for creatinine, with that value being higher for Black individuals, and that then got sort of perpetuated that, okay, well, that this probably means that we should then consider this in our equations. And I think the challenge, and this is something that was important for our task force to really consider, is that the challenge is that even though this was sort of carried forward historically, and not, I don't believe, you know, nefariously necessarily, but this was what the practice was, without really being carefully examined, the problem with that then is that really does continue, or did continue, to perpetuate this idea that there are these biological differences across race, when in fact, you know, race is a sociopolitical construct, and it is not based in biology. And so this is kind of how we landed where we are, and this is just one of the really important pieces that our task force had to then consider, and certainly hear from scholars who've done extensive thinking and writing around these concepts.
Before we move to some of the implications of the task force's recommendations, I'm curious, Keisha, from your perspective, particularly as you look at the pediatric community, how is this history manifest in terms of care for Black children with kidney diseases?
You know, it's a very interesting question. So when we look at the estimation equations we use in pediatrics, race has never been a part of that clinical algorithm. We use height. There were correction factors based upon sex, but race has never been a part of it. And so even with the efforts that we've recently, have started implementing with moving towards this one formula for adults, we still have this very interesting phenomena where a patient who is 17 years and 364 days with a GFR based upon our estimation formula that may be 52 goes to see the adult nephrologist the next day, and suddenly the estimated GFR is now 65. And so one of the things that is, you know, I think it's been a very difficult conversation for us as physicians with our families, is helping them understand that these are estimation equations. And although we as a community tend to apply very concrete decisions around a certain GFR level, we have to understand that at the end of the day, it is an estimation. And so there's still some work to talk about the potential disparities between that transition as a pediatric patient moving into adult care.
Just picking up on that point, I'm curious as to how do you work with your adult nephrology colleagues to ensure that those transitions are handled as appropriately as possible?
Yeah, so I live in a bubble, a very unique situation here at UNC Chapel Hill, where the pediatric and adult community are as one. And so our communication, whenever we're transitioning children within our umbrella, happens a little more organically. But more and more, we clearly have patients that are transitioning to adult nephrologists in their individual communities. And that transition can be a little bit tough, especially when we're focusing on those that have really advanced CKD and are nearing the point of needing kidney replacement therapy. And so one of the challenges I have, so if I have a young person with the GFR of around 25, I'm already working with the family to try to get them listed for kidney transplant. We are following them closely to see if they need other supportive measures. But based upon their eGFR in the adult world, they don't qualify to be listed with an estimated GFR of 25 just yet. And so it takes, so I think that communication physician to physician is very important in looking at the patient a little more globally, not just the number. But I think that as we're moving forward, we do see opportunities for us to think about some of the inequities that we see from pediatrics to adult. And we really need to think about how we sort of move away from this sort of concrete stance of how we look at GFR estimation.
So, Deidre, from your perspective as an adult nephrologist, as you think about some of these challenges, particularly you're not in North Carolina, you're in Baltimore, Maryland. Sort of curious as to sort of your perspective on these issues.
Yeah, so I think that transition is a critical time in the lives of these young people, and it's definitely something that we could be doing a lot better, I think, really across the board. I think so. Keisha and I are both at academic medical centers, where the accessibility of our colleagues who are in either, sort of for me, who are working with pediatric colleagues is going to be easier, than in a setting for our colleagues that are in practice and not tethered to academic centers. And so I think there's definitely a lot of opportunities there. And we as a community, though, need to kind of advance our messaging, I think, around, as Keisha was saying, around, like, what do these values mean as far as GFR, and so that they are a bit more translatable, not just between us going from when we go from pediatric to adult, but also when we think about when patients are traveling between health systems, mm-hmm. And how, the importance of streamlining the way that we're even reporting GFR values, for example, so that if a patient if they move to a different state or being seen by a different health system, that information carries over. And these are some of the considerations that our task force had to sort of think about, particularly in considering how our recommendations might then get implemented out sort of broadly across the country. Is this the sort of communication of this piece? And also, really, there's a great need, as Keisha alluded to, making sure that we as nephrologists understand this, but also particularly our primary care colleagues understand that these values are estimations, and sort of what does that mean, and when is there a need for additional testing, such as for cystatin C, to help to then provide a more accurate estimation of GFR in certain settings, certain clinical settings. I think we still have a long way to go to get that messaging right, that communication right, which should ultimately serve the patients that we're trying to serve.
Well, and you've alluded to the task force's third recommendation around the research agenda, and I have to say, when despite being involved from an administrative role in the task force, I was a little surprised when that recommendation was made. I'm just curious as to what is it the task force was trying to accomplish in terms of pretty much putting a marker down with the National Institutes of Health around you need a research agenda in this arena?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we, particularly given that we were very carefully looking at the available sort of studies around GFR estimation, pretty quickly realized that there's a need for, I think, several things. One would be the studies of measured GFR and the correlates of measured GFR, like what are the determinants of measured GFR in much more diverse patient populations than what has been included in some of the previous cohorts, and diverse not only from a racial or ethnic standpoint, but also a socioeconomic standpoint, sort of various exposures that people may have that we know could impact their kidney function. And then there's a need for better estimating markers of kidney function that could allow us to estimate GFR. So certainly creatinine has numerous, there's some benefits of it, but it also has some limitations. Cystatin C has limitations as well. And so out of our task force, we felt like that would be an area that should be right for research is to really help us get better at that, at understanding what determines measured GFR, but also understanding better ways to estimate it.
And Keisha, as you mentor sort of future nephrologists and you think about sort of the research community, how would you frame this discussion? Sort of what's your call to action in terms of what the community should be doing?
I think the call of action is that we need a departure from how we have approached these kinds of studies from before. We need different people coming to the table to help us think about these equations. We need to engage the full community, not only of our basic scientists, but we need our social scientists at the table to help us bring in that aspect of things. We need to think about different areas of expertise to help us come up with new innovative biomarkers. I mean, this is a huge field. The number of times that I'm rotating with medical students and I have to say the words, you know, creatinine is a pretty lousy marker of kidney function. I'm really tired of saying that out loud. You know, I want to be able to talk about settings where we use cystatin C and settings where we use NGAL and, you know, settings where we use some of these other biomarkers, and hopefully we'll come up with new ones that are accessible and measurable, no matter if you're in urban area New York or you're in a small town in Kansas. So, you know, I really do think that we need to be willing to move away from what's been comfortable for us as a research community and to really think a little bit more outside of the box of how we really get this work done. It's going to take collaboration across science, across technology, the social sciences. We have to engage our legislative bodies because, yes, we're going to have to make policy level changes to really be able to affect true change.
So just on that last point, what do you mean by potential policy level changes?
So when we think about, I think, a lot of the challenges that our patients have in regards to access to care, you know, it goes beyond just thinking about insurance and making sure that people have insurance. It includes, am I in an area where there's a broadband desert and so I can't connect with my providers because of that? It goes beyond, you know, education. We need to think about how do we grow this next generation of our workforce that we need. And we have to think about how schools are funded right now based upon property taxes and the disparities that we see because of that. And if we don't start in those very early ages, those foundational ages as young children, making sure that they are going down the path that they need to be able to get the education that's required to be able to help become part of our workforce, then a lot of our efforts are going to fall flat. So I really do think that as we are thinking very, you know, in a very focused fashion about biomarkers and how we measure kidney function and those kinds of things, we do have to think on a much larger population level.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm struck that ASN has to balance a set of activities that are unique to nephrology or unique to sort of the kidney community, simultaneously with a set of activities that are much broader, both from a medical professional perspective as well as from a societal perspective. So I guess as I'm thinking about it, there's almost three very distinct areas here. There's the sort of, I'm trying to figure out the best way to describe this in my own mind. So there's the, I guess going from the general to the specific. So there's the overall societal challenges. There's the overall challenges to the medical profession, including the pathway for people to become physicians, other health professionals, and scientists. And then there's the specific sort of clinical issues around nephrology. I guess, Deidre, if I outline that correctly, how, you know, we can't do everything at the same time, and how would you prioritize some of those issues? And Keisha, just to give you a heads up, I'm gonna ask you the same question. So
you've been warned. Thank you, Todd, for, you know, framing it in that way. So I would say a couple things about sort of where to start and sort of where to prioritize. I think there are, even within that nice rubric that I think you sort of outlined, there are areas both at the societal level and at the sort of broader medical professional level that we know have pretty direct impact on the people we serve with kidney disease, right? So I think that's the opportunity for us to sort of be able to hit each of those kind of three levels of influence, while also being focused on the population that we are ultimately kind of trying to serve. And so, as far as where to start in that, I think assessments of where there's the greatest potential for impact, I think make a lot of sense. And so, I'll give a few examples. So I think if we think about sort of at the societal level, there are certain policies that we know have great impact on the kind of healthcare workforce and the sort of broader set of things that we can do as a broad workforce, and then certainly has impact on us in terms of kidney disease. You could think about things like, you know, Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act as one example where that high level sort of policy certainly has impacts on all of those sort of those downstream factors, and for sure has impact on people's risk for kidney disease and also their outcomes if they already have kidney disease. For policies coming down the pike, or the potential for coming down the pike, that ASN can advocate for in that sort of space, that's the type of approach that we can take. Both of you know that I have a great interest in social drivers of the outcomes that we see in kidney disease, and so thinking about policies that we have, for example, around food access, that mm-hmm. kind of certainly exists at a kind of a high level, but also has at a national level, but also a state and local level. There are policies there as well that impact not just who gets kidney disease, but also their outcomes if they already do have it. And that's been documented. I was just enjoying reading an article out of the pediatric literature. Dr. Michelle Starr and her colleagues had done some work looking at food insecurity outcomes for children during children treated with dialysis during the pandemic. So it's both at the pediatric and the adult side that we're seeing those kinds of impacts. So I think of it as, you know, in a little bit of a more targeted way, but that yes, we can have impact on sort of each of those levels because each of them also impacts the patients that we serve.
Yeah, I very much agree with everything that Deidre just said. And I think one of the things that struck me, Todd, as you were sort of framing this is, I kind of think of this as like investments that we're making. And there are some things that we can do that are, I won't call low-hanging fruit because it's very important fruit, but things that will have a quick payout. And so looking at biomarkers, and there's a lot of data. I think pulling clinical trials that have already been done, and if we can learn how to share data and be comfortable with doing that. There are some questions that are probably answerable at the moment if we place our priorities in that realm. And then there are these much larger issues that require action now, but are going to take years and decades to pay off. But they are critically important as we're thinking about investing in our workforce. You know, I've been really proud of some of the steps that ASN has taken to think about how do we diversify our workforce with their loan mitigation program and other initiatives that have gotten off the ground. So we need more of that. Again, these are things that do require our full investment now, but we have to be willing to be patient to see the true benefit and the payout down the road.
Yeah, I want to circle back to these broader issues. But before I do, Keisha, you had mentioned clinical trials. And I know one of the sort of two related issues that I think ASN as an organization and in the kidney community is struggling with. One is this increase, you know, the good news is there's been a lot more activity in terms of clinical trials related to nephrology over the last few years and more to come, which is really exciting. But as you know, there's been a real challenge in terms of enrolling patients in those trials. So that's sort of one challenge. And then the other one, I think simultaneously, is it's been really hard to enroll diverse patient population that's more representative of the true nephrology patient population in those trials. I'm just curious as to, you know, in a very sort of specific way, if you have suggestions for how to address those challenges.
Yeah, so I've been really encouraged by some of the industry partners that I've been working with recently with their willingness to help us go to our patients in the communities. You know, a lot of our patients do not live around the academic medical centers where a lot of these trials tend to be housed. And so I think as much as we can, one, bring clinical care and research together to try to combine it so we're not adding to the burden of our patients. They have to come to us for clinical care. We need to go to them for clinical care. Let's see how we can combine those efforts so that we're not adding to their burden. Let's make sure that the patients that we are trying to help in disease categories that we are focusing on, let's make sure that those patients are at the table as we're designing the study. You know, are we asking the questions that they actually care about? We're sitting here focused on the GFR and making sure that it's preserved, which is obviously important, but maybe the patients care more about how swollen they're going to be or how fatigued they're going to be. Or, you know, is this going to require me to take 15 pills twice a day versus, you know, can this be an injection that I do at home once a week? So making sure that they are a part of the process of us building out the clinical trial so that we are answering, yes, the questions that as scientists we need, but at the end of the day, making sure that we truly are benefiting the whole patient, not just the clinical numbers that we're trying to fix. So I think that those are, you know, a few practical things that we can do. You know, there's a lot of conversation around mistrust, especially in communities of color. I really think that we need to be thoughtful, a little bit more thoughtful when we're throwing that concept around with mistrust, because I think it's a little bit more than that. Is, are we really providing the information? Are we really making things accessible? And not only accessible, can they get to appointments, but the information accessible. And so partnering with community partners that are there, that have a strong relationship with the communities that we're reaching, you know, I think is definitely important. But those are just a few thoughts off the top of my head about, you know, some of the practical things that we can do to make sure that our clinical trials reflect the populations of patients that we're taking care of.
Could I weigh in as well? Sorry, am I loud? Sorry. Thank you, Todd. Yeah, so I completely agree with all you said. I just wanted to add a bit on the notion of mistrust, in that, you know, I do think that when that term is, as you said, Keisha, when that term gets used, a lot of times what I worry is that is then sort of assigning blame to the individual, mm-hmm. you know, person living with kidney disease for their not doing any host, any number of things, you know, it's, it could be, I've seen it ascribed to, okay, well then, or sort of the blame laid with them for not taking medication, not being, you know, not coming to dialysis appointments, certainly not participating in clinical trials. And I think a reframing there, I think, would be so important for us to think about that these are, in many cases, this is earned, you know, distrust really on the part of these individuals, because numerous systems, including in many cases the healthcare system, have not demonstrated themselves to be trustworthy for these individuals, and that is what they are reacting to. And so, if we understand that it's not something that's out of our ability to influence, this concept of mistrust or this distrust, then I think we'll realize that there's a lot that we can actually do to earn that trust, and then to be able to engage a more diverse group of patients in these clinical trials. And I completely agree, and just want to underline what Keisha mentioned about the upfront engagement of these populations in the design of our trials, but also we should be better stewards then of the information that comes out of those studies. We don't do that very well either, like of the making sure that these populations that we've said, hey, we want you to be in our study, but then they never find out what the results were. They never find out sort of what happened with it. They never get that sort of return from those studies that they participated in. So I think we could do a better job on all these things.
Most of what we've talked about has been around potential policy changes in either local, state, or federal governmental responses. But as part of her answer, Keisha mentioned industry and sort of the for-profit sector. And I think we need to step back and recognize that at least half of medicine in the United States is for-profit. And there's increasing private equity and investment in kidney diseases in general, but particularly around value-based care companies. And it seems like there may be an opportunity here to work with some of these companies to build in healthcare equity, healthcare justice, some of the concepts we're talking about into their business. One thing that I've learned from Don Wesson, who I know has mentored all three of us, is that, you know, these types of initiatives are, they're good for medicine. They're good for the business of medicine, et cetera. So Deidre, do you want to go first? And then Keisha, you get the last word.
Sure. On the industry piece, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I mean, certainly from the research side, which we were just alluding to, now with numerous studies that are ongoing in the industry space that have implications for health equity, for sort of advancing kidney health equity. I think there's great opportunity. I think when I think of industry as well, I think of certainly these, you know, value-based these companies that are sort of providing this value-based care on a contractual basis to various health systems. I think of the health systems themselves and the fact that a number of them have been setting up programs that are, for example, addressing some of these types of social needs that that for sure policies influence, but also in the local environment, especially, you know, particularly when we think about larger health systems, they have a ton of influence and really can help to both shape the policies, but also can help to provide these sorts of services. You know, thinking about, for example, health systems that have set up housing programs for patients that they're serving who are facing housing insecurity. Certainly, there are numerous health systems that have various programs around food access that really have you know, great potential for addressing health disparities. Others who are using various health professionals or various professionals really to help serve patients who have needs, like using community health workers. I know that's a model that both health systems as well as some of these value-based programs or value-based organizations are employing. So I think there's a ton of opportunity there for benefits to be reaped for kidney patients.
You know, it's tough to really add on to that. You know, as I'm thinking about value-based care, healthcare equity, healthcare justice, these are all pieces of one figure in my mind, but they're not necessarily overlapping. You know, I always think of healthcare justice as really being kind of the vehicle to help us get to health equity. And as we're thinking about value-based care, if we're not careful and thinking about what that means for all of the communities we're trying to support, so there are times that I think that we can inadvertently introduce healthcare inequities because we're trying to fit, you know, everybody in one, you know, little square shape. And so at the end of the day, you know, the things that Deidre just mentioned, all that in my mind sort of speak to healthcare justice, you know, talking about food security, housing security, making sure that, you know, we have medicines that are accessible just, you know, in terms of being able to afford it, in terms of being able to consume it. You know, I think all of these things are incredibly important, but any time that we are, you know, really trying to move towards value-based care, which I think at its heart is important, altruistic, it is, you know, I think that the intention there is to provide good, solid, equitable care for everyone. If we don't pay attention to the healthcare justice side of things, then we're going to inadvertently create disparities that we were trying to avoid.
Well, thank you both.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.